This is Sabrina George interviewing John Antrobus for New Comedy Radio Part 1. John, would I be right in generically saying you're a writer?
Yeah.
You don't perform?
I do perform. I'm in the Gorton Simpson 60th anniversary playhouse on Saturday week. Might be too late for this, but
Gorton Simpson's a famous double-headed writing team that's so, loads of sitcoms.
Yeah,
telly.
I'm playing a constable in their piece called Impasse. They're doing four comedy playhouses, so yeah, that's fun.
You do this and perform it. Can you tell me what was the first action you did to become a writer? Can you remember?
Yeah, when I was in the Merchant Navy, I started writing, and I used to read it out to my cellmate, my cabin mate, the other apprentice, so that entertained him, and maybe the second mate was interested. So I thought I had an audience, although when you think sometimes we were a month at sea, you could call that a captive audience.
Seriously captive audience.
Yeah, seriously captive audience.
And what were you doing in the Merchant Navy?
Well, I was captivated by the uniform.
Fair enough.
And I thought,
many a girl has been.
Yeah, I thought, my God, that was my plan. I thought, yes, to be, you know, an apprentice there with a uniform. It's a lovely uniform anyway. So, but I realised that once you were in, you didn't wear it very often. It was not sort of the done thing. So, you know, I only wore it occasionally on leave.
So
you had to wear it on the ship. You had to wear it, but so that was good. So that lasted from the age of 17 to 19.
Then, so were you an officer?
Officer cadet.
You were officer cadet, right? So it was quite a fancy uniform when you wore it.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, and but it wasn't so romantic, and the Atlantic wasn't romantic, and the Pacific wasn't terrific, and the Black Sea wasn't what it ought to be. Or so, you know, so that didn't. There's a lot of rust chipping in the Red Sea.
What's that mean?
Well, it means you chip rust with a hammer before painting it. There's a lot of that going on. In the quite hot. I went to Abadan, which was then Persia, to the oil refinery, six times. So a lot of it was in sort of extreme heat. The work was all right. You could dream, and dreaming is my mode of operation, really. I need to do it more, not less, to actually succeed. So I dreamt away some days while rust chipping and painting, and also as apprentices you would have study periods of navigation, and that lasted 2 years, and I asked to leave, and I was on report for drinking anyway the last time. I know we were in Norway, and beautiful, up in the fields there, and one afternoon we're drinking in this sort of cafe bar, and there was a hoot from the oil tanker. I was on oil tankers down in the harbour, just idyllic really, and the captain sent the third mate up to, because I was drinking with the second mate and a couple of other crew members, and they couldn't, come on, we can't, we're waiting to leave. And of course we, the back end, or the stern, the second mate and I, well, that was our job with the crew to sort of untie, let go the back of the ship. So eventually we rolled down. I don't know what sort of report the second mate was on for his behaviour, but I certainly was on drink could be a problem at that time. Anyway, I didn't care because I didn't want to stay in the Merchant Navy. I'd had enough, and so I got out.
So what kind of things were you writing for your cellmates then?
Yeah, they were, I can't remember. It was a novel.
Oh, right. So right.
Yeah. Then when I was in, because of national service, if I stayed in the Merchant Navy till I was 26, I wouldn't have had to do national service, but I had to anyway, because I left when I was 19, the Merchant Navy. So I joined the Army, and I signed on for 3 years to go into the Education Corps when I could have qualified as a sergeant after I'd done my basic training and got a lot more money for doing maybe another year. But I so much enjoyed infantry training that I said I don't want to.
You must have been the only person on the planet that enjoyed infantry training.
Oh, it's great.
You hear nothing but terrible stories.
I tell you, when you've been, this is all good preparation for the army game. I only wrote two of them, and Carry On Sergeant, I wrote a script for that was digested into the main work. But no, it was brilliant. I mean, I was brought up in a military family. My father was a regimental sergeant major, and I've been in the army cadets. I was a strong kid. I'd done 2 years in the merchant navy and sweating it out, as a lot of manual labour, and I was used to being away from home. And I went into the army at the age of 19. So it was a double, and I was, the best recruit. These sorries of my intake.
So tell me what was so enjoyable about it.
Oh, God, you're romping around playing soldiers, shooting off guns. It's brilliant, it's just so, it's easy. And with laughing with your mates and everything, I had a lovely time. And then I got through, eventually, a War Office selection board, and I went to Eaton Hall, which was a short service commission. And that wasn't so much fun. While I was there, over a Christmas period, two guys committed suicide within a fortnight. And so I remember we all the cadets went into the main hall, and the CO was saying, "Hello, chaps. Please don't do this, just come and see us if there's anything really upsetting you, and take that man's bootlaces away, he looks a bit dodgy." Anyway.
And were you writing during that time as well?
I didn't have time when I was, I actually got through to Sandhurst, the Royal Military Academy, and that again was a doddle, and it's a third of it is academic, and I was behind academically because I'd left school in the fifth form, and a lot of them had completed sixth form pre-university and then gone to Sandhurst. But I was really on form, and I worked hard. I enjoyed working, and I caught up academically on other levels. On the military thing, I was super fit anyway, and keen, and I just enjoyed the work. So I just enjoyed it. So that lasted until my senior term, when I stopped enjoying it, and I decided that I didn't want to kill people when somebody said, "That's an enemy over there, pull that trigger." And I thought, it's going to be too late if I don't get out now. So I went to see...
What was the pivotal moment that made you suddenly realise that that was part of the job?
Well, there wasn't a pivotal moment. There was... I used to look out of the window, beautiful spring, early summer, and it's beautiful Sandhurst in lovely grounds, and I think I can just walk out of here. I can just walk away. I just want to walk away from all this. The rest of my life is out there, and I don't have to do this. And I stopped writing up my academic work, which was important. I was really on top of it at one time, but I think I've burnt out, and I don't know. Anyway, with other cadets in the tea room, we used to talk about pacifism, and strangely, other guys, and what it would be like just to say, "I don't want to do this." And so I went to see the general, and eventually, and he said, "Go away." Apparently, somebody else told me this, because I couldn't remember. He said, "Go away and think about it for a week, and come back and tell us." And this guy said, when you came back, he said, "You had two disciples." He said that, the word was spreading. He said that, yes, we wanted to leave as well. So they decided to, let me go very quickly. And I was sent on indefinite leave until the end of the 3 years. And the other thing that happened at Sandhurst was, in that term, I had written some sketches for the end of term review, which were all turned down. And so I thought, well, they don't appreciate my work. And And after I left Santos, it only took a very little while for me to be employed as a comedy scriptwriter.
How do you leap from Sandhurst into?
Well, what you do is you get a travel warrant to Brixton. Brixton. To Brixton, and you go down there, and because you want to go on the, say I'll go on the trawlers, which the money was supposed to be good. They would have taken me, but trawlers weren't coming in for 5 days or something like that, and I was in a hurry. So I decided instead I would go back to London and be either a famous comedian or a famous writer with the accent on famous. So I got to Leicester Square, and I thought it would be, and I booked in one night at the Union Jack Club, and then I thought it'll be fun to be penniless in London. And then see what happens. And
so kind of romantic.
Yeah. So I know I was down to half a crown, and I was sitting in Leicester Square, and I thought, now what do I do? So I went round the corner to Joe Lyons, and I got a job that very moment. A big corner, Joe Lyons Corner House, and I got a job as a waiter, and they paid you every day, and I had enough money to go back to the Union Jack Club and book in for them. For the night, so I did that a little while.
When was this? Was this
1954, something like
okay,
that?
Okay, so yeah. The war's over, but London's still pretty down.
Yeah,
right.
The war was over in I was bombed out during the war, so it gave me a sort of very objective view of, like, I think I've been very not seeking permanence. Well, I don't know what sort of effect being blitzed in Exeter had when you're under a steel table shelter and the windows come in, the doors blown off, and my brother, who was 3 years younger than me, he said to my mother, "Is this a practice?" Yes, Roger. What else? I remember Grandma was farting like a cart horse, so she was not full of faith, although she always carried a Bible. But my mother, who was a Christian, still is a Christian, although she's passed on, she said she actually heard a voice saying, "Don't worry, it's all right." And the funny thing was, I wasn't scared. I was always scared at school. I was scared of bullies. I lived a life of sort of being very excited and terrified, but I was not scared.
Bombs and rifle fire, not a problem.
No. And then after the raid, we looked out the kitchen window and the whole street behind us was ablaze. But it didn't, it was an adventure. It didn't, nothing sort of sank in, and we had to abandon the house, get out of Exeter. So that's my war time.
So when you were in Leicester Square working at the cafe, did you know anybody? Did you have any contacts, or did you?
No,
just
that would have spoiled it.
That would have ruined the whole thing.
No, but so how did I become very quickly famous and fluent in cash from this half crown and this dream? I used to walk past.
Did you have your uniform on?
No, I love the uniform. I like all my uniforms. Oh my God, I was an officer cadet in Santos. I loved all my different uniforms, all my identities. I used to dream different identities all the time. I still do. So where were we? Yeah, I've got this half crown. I used to walk past, if I walked past houses and I'd see people having dinner inside, I think if I knocked on the door, they'd probably take me in. I'm a nice guy. I'm sure they would have done. I'm so dreamy and naive. And good looking. I never used my looks properly. I was a fool to myself. And so during the war on Salisbury Plain, on the army camp Lark Hill, I used to wander across the plains, and I do Frankie Howard impressions. Apart, the other impression I would do was that I was a secret spy and I was going off at night saving England, and I got killed, and my father and mother would come to my funeral, and I would go, and they said, "We never knew, you know, we really underestimated our boy. He was saving England, we were so nasty to him." I thought that would teach him, you know. So, anyway,
and this is all from the radio, Frankie Howard.
Oh, yeah, my wartime fantasies of saving England were, they weren't related to Frankie Howard, but Frankie Howard was and the beautiful scripts written by Eric Sykes, was about taking elephants down the tube and everything like that. I just loved them, and I'd do
that
my own.
That was all from the radio, you never saw them live?
Oh, no, all from the radio. Radio was, we'd rush back from the cinema. I loved the cinema. I used to go to the local Gaff, it was called, the cinema in the Lark Hill, and all the soldiers would be going to the cinema in the, you know, 40s before the D-Day and everything like that, and we'd have our sixpence, and if it was not a U film, we'd ask the soldiers to take us in, or the other thing was we'd ask one of the kids to go in and leave to push the door open, and we'd sneak in and we'd just sit in and watch cinema we'd see it, like Sergeant York I saw three times from the moment I got in, my favourite film. And when you were in the cinema, if anybody was romantic and kissing, Michael Wilding kissing Margaret Lockwood or something like that, all the soldiers would be saying, "Go on there, get in there, lad, get them off, go on, get them off," and we'd be like, "Get them off, get them off."
No idea what you're talking about.
If it was a cowboy and Indian, and the cavalry started, and the cavalry arrived, everyone went, "Oh!" Then we were all cheering. So it's a big participation event, and then sort of getting home in time for the Frankie Howard radio show and everything. So life was exciting, and in the media, in terms of media, plus my comics, my adventure and Wizard and the Hotspur, and earlier Beano and Dandy. But that was, a very junior kid. But I loved the smell of the newsprint and to get my adventures, Rockfish Road,
you never wanted to be Michael Wilding with getting it off? You wanted to be the...
I don't know, when I was 14, this is after, a little bit, at the end of the war we moved to London, and I remember I went to the local library, we were in Thornton Heath, and I picked up H.G. Wells and I started reading, and I thought, I suddenly found a new world in reading. And there was a book, I'm not sure if it was called The Eternal Jew, but it had a phrase in it called unendurable pleasure indefinitely prolonged. I wasn't quite sure what it was, I've been seeking it ever since. But I did an exhausting search. So
is it going to have that on your brain? So I found it.
So
there you were, being a waiter.
There I was, being a waiter. So what am I going to do?
Half a crown.
Yeah. So I was able to move out of...
Can I just ask you quickly, what is the Union Jack Club?
It's for servicemen.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you qualified for that?
Yeah, I still was qualified.
It's not an entertainment...
Well, I was still in
club.
The army, actually, I think. I can't remember. I don't know if they were still paying me. Sometimes I have dreams where I want to be a writer, but I've got to leave the army because I'm 70 years old or something, and most of them are cadets. I'm still at Sandhurst, and I'm thinking, I've got to pack, I've got to go, you know, I've got to make a decision to get out. You know, I've got to trust that I can make a living as a writer. I hope I don't dream about that tonight. So, we're still waiting for this cliffhanger. how did I actually become quickly?
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe quickly, maybe slowly, but how come you made that leap from army waiter, Union Jack Club, which wasn't entertainment? How?
Yeah.
Because that's a huge chasm between those two, isn't it?
Yeah, well, don't forget, I'd already decided I wanted to be a famous comedian or a famous writer.
Right.
So then I found lodgings in the Cromwell Road, and another guy from Sandhurst came. He's called David Hearn, who became a famous photographer. He left Sandhurst as well, so I think he was the only disciple who actually followed me. And anyway, he needed to live rent free for a while. I'm not quite sure when he joined me, but it certainly wasn't before I made some money. It's just how it worked out. And so I went to the windmill. That's the place. That's where
windmill.
They start. You see, that's where you start. So and they had morning auditions, and I drank Merry Down cider before I went. And I knew
this is
I had,
to be a comic.
Yeah, to be a comic. And I had a coat hanger and a candle, which I lit before I went on. And I went on and I started started doing a sort of sergeant major thing about drilling the audience. When Sheila Van Damme's in the, you know, there wasn't an audience, it was an audition. And they said, very quickly, it only took about 20 seconds, they said, all right, thank you, we'll let you know. And I said, well, you haven't got my address. They said, never mind. I know before, I was so nervous. I know the first time I'd gone to the windmill, before I had the foresight to drink, I thought I might be auditioned immediately, and I was so scared because I went to the stage door and I asked for Sheila Van Damme, and they said up on the first floor. I went straight up to the roof, past the first floor. I took three deep breaths. I thought, I can't bear this. And then I went down and I went out, and I never even tried to see it. I just left, you know.
Literally anyone walk off the street and just go up to the stage door
and
say,
yeah.
Right.
Well, that's what I did.
Right. No experience,
No, you didn't need experience for an audition. And because I was too nervous, and without the drink, and with the drink, of course, I was, it was impossible. I was just all over the place, no finesse at all, so I'll say, drunk, to put it bluntly. And so, anyway, I discovered very quickly that the landlady in the lodgings in Cromwell Road was Bill Kerr's mother. So I told her.
Bill Kerr.
Bill Kerr is an Australian comedian, lovely guy. He actually played the windmill. He used to say, I'm only here for 4 minutes. And he'd say, look, I don't want to worry you, but I don't like the look of that chandelier up there. It looked very insecure. I mean, I'm not saying you should move. It's not for me to say that, but I'm just saying I wouldn't sit under it anyway. And, Bill Kerr's mother introduced me to Bill Kerr, and I said, I'm fantastic at writing comedy scripts, you know. He said, I'll introduce you to Ray Gordon and Alan Simpson, so come along next Sunday to the Playhouse Theatre where we're recording Hancock South Hour. So I went down there and I saw Ray and Alan after the show, and they said, send in a sample Hancock. So I went back and just scribbled out.
And you knew Hancock inside out?
I loved Hancock, yeah. I mean, even when we were at Sandhurst, we used to run to listen to Hancock, and even more favourite at Sandhurst was the Goon Show, and everybody was doing Goon Show voices in those days anyway. So, and I thought, I can do this standing on my head. So I thought, it's being a famous, you know, comedy writer, it's just made
a doddle.
And so anyway, I wrote this script, some pages, longhand, got it into Ray and Alan. Took it, I don't know how I got it to them anyway, probably gave it to Bill Kerr or Bill Kerr's mother anyway. And they liked it, and enough to take me on, which didn't surprise me, you know. and I thought, well, they can go on holiday for a couple of weeks now because I'll write the Hancock show for them, you know. But they didn't go on holiday, and I wasn't hired to take over from them on the Hancock show. But what happened was, I turned up the first day and in a herringbone suit and with an umbrella, still in my Tory officer cadet mode, and I met Beryl Virtue, who's the secretary then, and sort of pretty well running Associated London Scripts, and she said to me, we're thinking of teaming you up with another new writer we've only been in a little while called Johnny Spate. So I said, alright. I said, where is he? She said, well, he's out to lunch. I said, okay. She said, that's the office. I said, alright, I'll get started. She said, there's a pilot script for radio. I said, it's a sort of about a private dick, you know, detective, whatever. I said, I got the idea. I'll get started on that. So after lunch, Johnny comes back, and he's never met me in his life. I'm sitting behind the desk. I said, oh, hello, Johnny. He said, what the fuck are you doing there? You know. I said, as you're out to lunch, I got started on the script, and I gave it to you. Let's have a effing look at that, you know. And all right, to swear on this tape, what's your policy? Very much encouraged.
Let's be accurate, yes.
All right, so give me that fucking script then. And what the fuck's this, he says, you know. So we read it through, and it actually, one gag was, so we can use one of these gags. I said, all right. So then we wrote together, and no, it was nice. And
why are you using your experiences as a detective on the Salisbury Plains?
No, I just,
weaving that in.
I don't know. No, it was just, anyway, that never came to anything. But Terry Nation and Dick Barry, Terry Nation of Daleks fame, later Daleks fame, I often wondered why he kept saying, we will destroy you. I didn't sort of relate that he was mulling over in his mind. He never said much else. But they were writing All My Eye and Kitty Blewett, and they were, and Dick Barry, a charming guy, went to Australia, and always, never without an apple in his hand, always, must be the healthiest apple eater I've ever met, anyway, very good at that, and Terry Nation used to drink milk, and always have a bottle of milk by his side, so we joined in to make a foursome, and wrote with them the last three episodes of All My Eye and Kitty Blewett, and I mean, they asked us in because they needed a bit more whatever we, Johnny and I, could bring, and then Ray and Alan couldn't write the Frankie Howard radio show because they had other commitments, and so there we were, hired to do 13 scripts for Frankie Howard. So the boy was doing all,
what,
yes,
you and Johnny Spate,
me and Johnny Spate and Terry Nation and Dick Barry,
all four of you, right?
Yeah, but Johnny and I were in many ways sort of leading because we were impossible
with your brilliant,
yeah, because we were impossible, and so probably didn't give Terry and Dick much room. It was too much let's put it nicely, too much talent in the same room, and the egos of Johnny and myself were
but you and Johnny got on like a house.
Oh, we got on well. We used to and then I was like, oh yes, Johnny, everything like that. And the play that I wrote about this is called A Good Report, that we did at the White Bear about 4 or 5 years ago, and Johnny was an unreformed Stalinist, and I'm sort of vaguely right wing, as my parents were, and Johnny's effing by, you want to read Bergson's fucking theory of fucking evolution? I said, oh yes, right, and George Bernard fucking Shaw, you know, straighten your mind out, John. Right, Johnny, I get round to that. And within 3 months, I'm sort of, you know what, Johnny, I said, my parents, they betrayed me, they're class enemies. Yeah, they're class enemies, and it's a, I said, I'll grow up, John, leave them alone, give them, you know. I said, well, I've got to tell them. He said, you don't have to tell them. He said,
so the two of you had slightly swapped sides.
Yeah,
political,
well, John was always very practical, and I was just, he gave me an idea, and it was like alcohol to me, which I also imbibed liberally with Johnny, but I could, there was no balance in it, I was just like extreme, and so so that
we just, we'll have to take just break the start and do part two in a minute. Just a minute. Are you alright with that?
Yeah.